Aristotle's profoundly interested in nature. This is evident in almost all his writings. But the most systematic exposition of his philosophy of nature is in the lectures, whose title is usually translated as the Physics, from the Greek word meaning nature. Unlike many earlier and later philosophers, Aristotle thinks it's ridiculous to argue about whether or not nature itself truly exists.
To try to prove that nature exists is laughable, for it is obvious that many things exist by nature. And to prove the obvious from what is not obvious is characteristic of one who is not able to judge what is self-evident and what is not. This sort of person is clearly possible, though, like a man blind from birth who reasons about colors. And so it is like reasoning about names with nothing in mind to correspond to them.
Aristotle explains what makes something natural by comparing a natural substance to something produced by art.
Some things exist by nature, whereas other things exist by other causes. Animals and their parts exist by nature, as do plants and the elementary parts of physical things, for example, earth, air, fire, and water. These, we say, and things like them, exist by nature. For it appears that all of the things mentioned are different from things not constituted by nature. What exists by nature appears to have the principle of movement or rest within themselves, whereas a bed or a cloak or something of that sort has in itself no inherent impulse to change. It is the same with each thing that is the product of art. None of them has the principle of its own making within itself.
Things that develop naturally not only exist by nature, but they also have a nature. For example, we might say that it's a flower's nature to grow towards the light, or that it's a cat's nature to be standoffish. One of the principal tasks of the student of nature, Aristotle thinks, is to discover the natures of different things. He says some of his predecessors thought that the nature of a substance is in the material that composes it.
It seems to some people that the nature and essence of natural things is their material element. In a bed, it would be the wood, or in a statue, it would be the bronze. And if each of these materials stands in the same relation to some other substance, as the bed and the statue stand in relation to them, for example, if water is the material of bronze or gold, or earth is the material of bones or timber, then these materials provide the nature of the others.
Aristotle rejects this view. To say that something has a nature means its distinctive properties make it recognizable as a certain kind of thing. But the material that something's made of is not one of these distinctive properties. The fact that an oak tree is made of wood doesn't distinguish it from a bed made of oak. Both are made of the same material. Aristotle's own view is that the nature of something is to be found in the other component of any substance, its form.
The shape or form, according to the definition, is the nature and essence of a natural entity. A thing's nature is the shape and form of things having within themselves the principle of motion. Entities do not have a form existing apart from the entities themselves, except conceptually.
Aristotle believes that a substance's nature or essence is identified with its form. And having an essence enables a substance to perform the functions that characterize its species. So Aristotle thinks that all substances of the same nature will tend to perform the same basic functions. All oaks will drop acorns in the fall, stalks of corn will produce their grain, and humans will have the capacity to think. Now that we have some ideas about the true nature of things, we might ask an obvious question. Will the true nature of something today also be its true nature tomorrow? Aristotle says nothing in nature is utterly static. Now, it's easy to say things change, but it's tough to say exactly what change is. It's hard to predict what will change and what will stay the same. And how can we say exactly when important changes take place? Changes like the beginning and the end of life. Aristotle says all changes can be classified in at least one of four basic ways.
Change with respect to substance is generation and corruption. Change with respect to quantity is increase or decrease. Change with respect to affection is alteration. Change with respect to place is locomotion.
Generation refers to the change that occurs when a new substance is actually created. Generation occurs when an embryo is formed by the union of an egg with a sperm. Similarly, corruption refers to the change that occurs when a sensible substance ceases to exist. The second type of change, increase and decrease, obviously refers to changes in size. Alteration, the third basic type of change, occurs when a man goes from being pale to being tanned, or from being hot to being cold. Finally, locomotion takes place when a natural substance moves from one place to another. A rock falling from the top of a hill to the bottom has experienced locomotion. Aristotle argues that nature's many changes always exemplify three simple principles: the property an object changes from, the property it changes to, and the object itself that endures throughout this change.
Change is always a complex matter. There is something that has become. There is something that comes to be this, which can be understood in two ways: what endures through the change, and what has been changed. For instance, in the uncultured person who becomes cultured, being uncultured is what has been changed. The man is what endures through the change.
In Aristotle's example, an example of alteration, the property of being uncultured exists when change begins and ceases when change ends. A second property, the property of being cultured, didn't actually exist at the beginning of the change, but it came into existence. The third element, the man himself, endures throughout the change, and he bears the two properties. Aristotle calls this third element the substratum of the change. All of this may seem obvious enough when we think about Aristotle's last three types of changes: increase or decrease, alteration, and change of place. But what about the first type, generation and corruption? What substratum underlies the change when a new substance comes into existence or an old substance ceases to exist? Aristotle answers that even when this sort of dramatic change takes place, something must endure throughout the change.
It is evident that all substances and every other thing that exists independently come to be from some substratum. For there is always a substratum from which what has become is derived. The processes by which things come into existence may be divided thusly: change of shape. For example, a statue of a man made from bronze. Additions, as in things that develop from a different substance. Subtraction, for example, a Hermes statue having been chipped from a stone. Combination, for example, the parts combining to make a house. It is clear, then, that in all things that come about, there is a substratum which undergoes the process.
In each case of change, a new entity comes into existence, but an underlying material was present before, during, and after the inception. When a statue is created, bronze or stone persists through the creation. When a house is built, the wood endures through the change. Aristotle then rejects the idea sometimes held by theologians and other philosophers that something could be created out of absolutely nothing. If Aristotle's right, at no time in the history of the universe could new substances have been simply created. Any change whatever, regardless of how long ago the change took place, there must have been an underlying, unchanging substratum. This ancient perception reflects the rule of modern physics. Matter can neither be created nor destroyed, only altered. In every change, then, there's a new property, but it's a new property of a substratum that existed before and after the change. Still, there's a question about its source. When a leaf changes from being green to being red, where did the redness come from? Aristotle answered that all changes are really times when something passes from the potential to the actual. While the leaf was actually green, it was only potentially red. When it changed color, it became actually red. This movement from the potential to the actual explains why every living thing develops in a way that manifests its essence. Let's consider again one of the most important kinds of change, the beginning of new life. The form or essence of every living organism is present potentially in the organism when it's conceived. Gradually, it matures and the form becomes actual. It's then capable of the various functions of its species. Aristotle frequently refers to this process as the way the essence of a living substance becomes actualized. So when we hear someone talk about self-actualization, we know he means a human being who's changed potential capacity into reality. This isn't to say, of course, that everything has the potential to become everything else. The potential form of an object depends upon the characteristics of the material substratum that can change.
We must distinguish between when each thing exists potentially and when it does not. A potentiality for something does not always exist. For instance, is Earth potentially a man? No, but only when it becomes sperm, and perhaps not even then. Just as not everything can be healed by medicine or even by chance, but there is something which has the potential for it. And this is what is potentially healthy.
Only human tissue, even while it's still an embryo, has the potential to become an adult human being. We've been examining the basic categories Aristotle uses to understand all natural change, but the student of nature will want to understand the specific causes of the various changes in nature. Of course, the general issue of causation is one of the most important subjects in philosophy. Without some understanding of causation, we can never understand why things are the way they are. Aristotle thinks causation can be explained in four ways. His explanation has come to be known as the doctrine of the four causes.
One sense of cause is said to be the material from which something generated comes about. For example, the bronze of the statue or the silver of the container. Another cause is the form or the type of thing it is. The account of this is the same as the essence of the thing. Another cause is the immediate source of the change, or the ending of the change. Generally, it is whatever makes or changes anything about the thing that is made or changed. Then there is the final cause. This is the goal or the end for the sake of which the change takes place. For example, health is the end for the sake of which one takes a walk. Why does he take a walk? We say in order that he may be healthy. And in saying this, we think we are showing the cause of his walking.
Aristotle's first three causes are pretty straightforward. Sometimes we explain an object's characteristics by describing the material it's made from. We explain the fact that a tree burns because it's made of wood, or we can explain an object's properties by describing its form or essence. We say a particular tree has a specific type of leaves because it's an oak. Aristotle's third type of cause is the efficient cause, a force that initiated an event or terminated an ongoing event. A high wind might have uprooted an oak. But Aristotle's fourth cause refers to a goal, an end to be achieved by change. This gives Aristotle's theory of nature its unique place in the history of science. As his own example illustrates, we often use this fourth type of explanation, which philosophers call a teleological explanation, to explain a human being's intentional movements. As we heard Aristotle say, we walk to be healthy. But he also thinks changes throughout nature can be explained in terms of goals or ends to be achieved. To pick one of his favorite examples, leaves grow out over a piece of fruit for shade, to cool it. He says we explain why this happens in terms of the result. The fruit is shaded and cool. Aristotle says a natural substance tends to change in characteristic ways. Living substances develop into adult members of their species, thus realizing their essence and nature. The organism changes in a characteristic way in order to perform the characteristic function of the species. For Aristotle, realizing one's nature is the goal of natural development. Individual members of a species change. They're born, develop, reproduce, and die. But there's never a change in the essence of a species. The essence of man is the same today as it was thousands of years ago. Only individual men have come and gone. In Book 8 of the Physics, Aristotle takes up a series of objections which might be raised against his views about natural change. He refers specifically to objections based on the doctrines of Empedocles, an earlier Greek philosopher of science. Empedocles held three views directly opposed to Aristotle's. First, he argued that nature is blindly mechanistic. Hence, nature does not change simply to achieve natural goals. Second, Empedocles said more complicated species develop from less complicated species. And third, he said some species have survived and others have died off because the survivors adapted to their environment and the extinct species did not. Aristotle paraphrases Empedocles' case.
There is an objection that nature does not act for the sake of a goal, or because it is better that nature acts as it does. But just as Zeus makes it rain, not in order that the corn may grow, but of necessity, so, if the grain is destroyed by the rain while still on the threshing floor, it did not rain for the purpose of destroying the grain. Why, then, should it not be the same with the parts of the body that exist by nature? For example, why should it not be by necessity that the front teeth grow up sharp and suitable for tearing food, and the back teeth are broad and flat and suitable for grinding food? And the same can be said about the other parts of the body, where they seem to exist for a purpose. In all such cases where these characteristics come together, just as if they came about for a purpose, those survived which were suitably organized by chance. Those not so suitably organized perished and still perish.
Empedocles says things occur in nature by chance. Those things that survive are simply fortunate in being well suited to nature's course. But in response, Aristotle offers a series of arguments to explain why change occurs. He first asks whether it's reasonable to believe with Empedocles that chance can explain why natural change is so predictable. If Aristotle's right, everything that regularly occurs in nature must be aimed at some natural goal.
All natural changes occur either always or for the most part. But this is not what occurs when things happen either by luck or by chance. For it does not seem to be by luck or coincidence that it often rains in the winter, but if it rains often in the dog days. And it is not by coincidence that there is scorching heat in summer, but not in winter. If, therefore, these occurrences are either by coincidence or for a purpose, and if it is not possible for these occurrences to be either by coincidence or by chance, then they must be for a purpose.
Aristotle's second argument compares objects made by art, that is, artifacts, and objects occurring in nature.
In those things in which there is a goal to be achieved, the first and the successive stages are done for the sake of achieving the end. Thus, as in matters of art, so it is done in nature, and as it is done in nature, so it is done in art, unless there is some impediment. The change takes place for a purpose. Therefore, natural change takes place for a purpose. For example, if a house came about by natural processes, it would come about in the manner it does not by art. And if things that come about by nature are brought about not only by nature but by art, they would come about in the same manner that they do now. If, then, what is produced by art is for the sake of a goal, it is clear that the same is true of what occurs by nature.
In Aristotle's third argument, he says that even some members of the lower species act in ways that are plainly goal-oriented.
That which the lower animals do is neither the result of craftsmanship, nor research, nor deliberation. Some actually raise the question of whether spiders and ants and other animals act from intelligence or something else. Going gradually down the scale, it appears that plants too have organs produced for the sake of the end. For example, the leaves are produced for the sake of shading the fruit. Hence, if it is by nature and for a purpose that the swallow makes its nest and the spider its web, and plants make leaves for the sake of the fruit, and the roots turn not up but down for the sake of nourishment, it is clear that the cause is such as we have described and exists in the things that come about by nature.
For Aristotle, then, nature can't be a random collection of things driven by blind, haphazard forces. Every natural substance has within it both the potential and the tendency to actualize its essence. That's how it tends to achieve its natural goals. Once an object's essence is actually present in it, that object can perform characteristic functions, like propagating its own kind, functions that are unique to the species. Nature, as Aristotle conceives it, is like a beneficent parent. Nature endows her creatures with the qualities they'll need to carry out their functions and to fulfill their natures. Aristotle refers to Anaxagoras, the pre-Socratic philosopher, to explain how nature prepares man to fulfill his natural function.
Anaxagoras asserts that the possession of hands makes man the most intelligent of living creatures. Actually, it is clear that it is because he is the most intelligent that man got hands. Hands are like an instrument. But nature, which is like an intelligent man, always gives the instrument to the animal which can use it, just as it is more appropriate to give flutes to the flute player than to give to someone who possesses flutes the skill to play them. If, therefore, nature always does what is best among possible ways of acting, it is not through the possession of hands that man is the most intelligent creature. Instead, he possesses hands because he is the most intelligent creature.
If natural change has always occurred in much the same way it occurs now, as Aristotle insists it has, then why and how does nature constantly provide the right conditions for each species to survive? For this explanation, we must turn to Aristotle's account of how the universe is structured. As we well know, how the universe is structured has been and continues to be one of the most important and frequently asked questions in philosophy, religion, and science. Aristotle thinks that the universe has always existed, but he believes its size is not infinite. In his short work, On the Heavens, he writes,
"The shape of the universe is necessarily spherical, for that is the shape that is most appropriate to what is primary by nature. The universe itself is what is encompassed within the extreme circumference, since we habitually say that the whole or everything is the universe."
Aristotle's convinced, based on the evidence available to him, that the universe is spherical. If he's right, it makes sense to talk about the center of the universe and about movement away from and towards the center. Aristotle does exactly this, and he therefore derives the properties of heaviness and lightness. These are some of the earliest recorded efforts to describe things that are today described by Isaac Newton's concept of gravity.
Let us say that something is heavy when it naturally moves to the center of the universe, and light when it naturally moves away from the center. The heaviest will be that which moves to the bottom of all things which move downward, and the lightest will be that which rises to the top of all things that move upward. Everything, then, which moves either up or down, will possess lightness or heaviness or both, although not both relatively to the same thing.
Aristotle thinks that simple observation reveals how nature ranks what he believes to be the four basic material elements: earth, water, air, and fire. Nature assigns each of the four basic elements to its proper place in the universe according to its relative weight. Earth, Aristotle thinks, is plainly the heaviest. Its natural tendency is to fall towards the center of the universe. Water, on the other hand, is lighter than Earth, but heavier than air. Its natural place is to rest on top of Earth, but beneath air. Finally, fire, the lightest of the four, will tend to move away from the center of the universe, and hence away from Earth. Of course, today we know that there are more than 100 different chemical elements. And we know that these elements are composed of a yet undetermined number of even more basic particles. But let's remember that Aristotle was taking the first step along a path that was to prove fruitful, probably beyond his wildest dreams. We can now see how Aristotle thinks the universe is structured. Since our planet is made primarily of Earth, it occupies the center of the universe. Once again, Aristotle thinks we can simply look into the sky to see that the moon, sun, planets, and fixed stars move in concentric orbits around the Earth. The moon's orbit is the closest, and the fixed stars' orbits are farthest away. But if these heavenly bodies naturally move in circular paths around the Earth, several important consequences follow. First, there must be some fifth material element, which Aristotle calls ether. Ether must exist because anything that by nature moves in a circle around the center of the universe must be different from earth, air, fire, or water. In discussing this concept, Aristotle refers to the space between the moon and the outer edge of the universe as the upper region.
We say that the upper region is made up of a material different from fire and from air, but it exists in different degrees of purity, especially as it gets closer to air and the part of the universe surrounding the Earth.
In the region below the moon, that is, in the region beneath ether, each natural substance comes into being and eventually ceases to exist. Aristotle explains that all natural substances in this sublunary region eventually will dissolve because they're made of some combination of earth, air, fire, and water. They also contain some mixture of opposing elements, hot and cold, wet and dry. If something's composed of opposing properties, Aristotle thinks, it eventually will dissolve. But anything that's composed of ether, the fifth basic element, was never created. It contains no opposing element, so it cannot be destroyed.
We see that all natural bodies, which are subject to being affected, undergo increase and decrease. For example, the bodies of animals, of plants and their parts, and similarly, of their elements. If, then, the body whose nature is to move in a circle is not subject to increase or decrease, we may certainly conclude that it is not subject to alteration. This is shown clearly enough from observation. For in all past time, according to memories handed down, it appears that there has been no change in the heavens, either as a whole or in any of its parts.
Because heavenly bodies contain ether in varying degrees of purity, and because anything composed of ether is eternal, Aristotle concludes that the heavenly bodies always have and always will continue in their circular paths around the earth. This is known as a geocentric or earth-centered view of the universe. It can be contrasted with today's heliocentric or sun-centered understanding of the way the planets move. Aristotle believes that his view of the universe helps us to be certain that nature will provide the right conditions to sustain the species. For though the sun travels eternally around the earth, its path is elliptical. This path sometimes brings the sun closer and other times farther away from the earth. This changing distance between sun and earth brings on the seasons of warmth and coolness. Living things tend to procreate when it's warm and to die when it's cold.
Thus, we see that generation occurs as the sun comes close, and decay occurs as it retreats from the earth. Generation and passing away will always be continuous and will never fail because of the cause we have mentioned.
To Aristotle, the eternal circular motion of the sun in the heavens can help explain the cycle of existence. In this cycle, living things develop into their respective essences, propagate themselves, and eventually pass out of existence. But what causes the eternal motion of the sun? Aristotle's answer, as we might expect, is that the sun moves in an orbit. The sun's orbit is linked to other orbits in which the planets move. So, as the planets move, the sun moves. The planetary orbits are in turn linked to the orbits of fixed stars at the very edge of the universe. As Aristotle conceived the universe, then, the stars move in the outermost heavens, and this moves the other orbits of the other heavenly bodies in a perfectly mechanical way, much like a system of gears. The Earth, at the center of the universe, does not move at all. Aristotle uses the term sphere to refer to the orbits of the heavenly bodies.
It is on account of this that other motions move one body. Because the motions before the last one move many bodies, and the last sphere moves many spheres. The work of the last one, therefore, will belong to the others.
Still, some principle has to explain the motion of the outermost orbit of the fixed stars. Aristotle recognizes he must explain why motion takes place eternally in the universe. To find his answer, we need to return to his work, The Metaphysics.
There is something which is eternally moved with an unceasing motion, and this is a circular motion. This is clear not only in theory, but in fact. Thus, the ultimate sphere of the heavens must be eternal. Therefore, there is something which moves it. Since what is in motion and moves something else cannot be an ultimate mover, there is something which moves and which is not itself in motion. Something both a substance and an actuality.
Aristotle says that the eternal circular movement of the heavens ultimately can be explained only if there is an ultimate mover, something that is not itself moved by anything else. But how can something move the stars without in any way being in motion itself? To see how this can be, we must piece together Aristotle's explanation from various writings. First, in the lecture called On the Heavens, Aristotle tells us that we must assume that the stars are alive and have souls. This notion was by no means foreign to the Greeks of antiquity.
We might think that the stars are mere bodies or units moving in an orderly way and yet do not have souls. But we ought to think that they have souls and act.
Second, the souls of the stars are not animal souls, so the stars have no animal desires. Rather, they have intellect, and desires that are directed solely by their intellect. In the Metaphysics, Aristotle explains that an unmoved mover can cause the stars to move simply by being thought about and desired, by being an object that is loved.
But an object of thought and an object of desire produce motion without being moved. For the real good is the object of the intellect. The object for the sake of which emotion occurs can be unchanging. It produces motion by being loved.
In his work, The Physics, Aristotle explains that the stars ultimately are moved by a fourth cause. Here, the purpose, the goal of a movement, explains why it took place. The stars move in order to be, as much as possible, like something they understand to be good. Since the stars must move eternally, the goodness they seek also must be eternal. Aristotle sometimes calls this eternal and immutable goodness the unmoved mover, or the prime mover. The stars imitate its perfection in the only way they can, through eternal motion in perfect circles around the heavens. We shouldn't be surprised that Aristotle calls this perfect, eternally unchanging being God.
We hold that God is a living being, eternal, most good, so that life and eternal existence belong to God. For that is what God is.
Here we learn about Aristotle's answer to one of the most basic philosophical questions, the existence and nature of God. The philosopher can come to know God's nature, Aristotle says, simply by thinking about demonstrated principles and their implications.
This substance can have no magnitude, and hence has no parts and is indivisible. And this being must be unaffected by anything, and must be unalterable in every respect.
Aristotle concludes that God can have no physical characteristics, in line with his doctrine that motion is caused by a being that never changes. As we've seen, anything that has physical characteristics must be composed of matter, and anything made of matter is always subject to change. Since the unmoved mover can't be material and yet is alive, Aristotle reasons that it must be pure intellect. The function of the intellect is to think. But we must not assume that the unmoved mover is even aware of the universe whose motion it sustains. In fact, Aristotle argues that God can have no such awareness.
God must think about either himself or something else. If he thinks about something other than himself, he must think about the same thing always, or different things. Does it make a difference whether he thinks about what is noble or what just happens to be true? It is absurd to say that this thought is concerned with some objects. It is clear that God thinks about what is most divine and most honorable, and does not change. A change, of course, would be for the worse, and would imply motion of some sort. Therefore, if this is to be avoided, the divine mind thinks of itself, if this is the best object of thought, and the thinking of the divine mind is thinking about thinking.
Unfortunately, Aristotle does nothing to explain this perplexing notion more clearly. We're left to wonder what it means to say God spends eternity in thought about thought. This much, however, is clear. Aristotle's God is not the intimate, personal God of the theologians. Aristotle's God doesn't consider the universe or the creatures that inhabit it. But this God's perfection is mirrored, however imperfectly, throughout the changing universe. Aristotle's thoughts about the nature of God would shape the course of Western theology for the next 2,000 years. St. Thomas of Aquinas especially emphasized Aristotle's insights into motion and causation. In his philosophical discussions of God more than 1,500 years after Aristotle lived, Aquinas would combine the great philosopher's insights with more traditional teachings of the Church in an effort to prove that God exists. In the following passage, Aristotle reveals one of the most telling features of his concept of the universe. The universe is, to use the Greek term, a cosmos, a place of order.
We must also consider in which of two ways the nature of the universe contains the good, the highest good, whether as something separate and by itself, or as the order of the parts. Probably in both ways, as an army does. The good of the army is to be found in its order and in its leader, but more in the latter, because the order depends upon him and not he on the order. And all things are somehow ordered together, but not all in the same way. The fishes, the birds, the plants. The world is not a place where they have nothing to do with one another. In fact, they do. For all things are ordered together for one end. All things must come to be dissolved into their components. And there are other functions in which all things share in the good of the whole.
In Aristotle's universe, nature is a magnificent craftsman. This craftsman, doing nothing without a purpose, has arranged the whole so that each species will continue to exist forever. Each natural substance sustains nature by perpetuating its species. Aristotle's God remains absolutely unchanging, but there is a sense in which this God, too, sustains the natural order. As we've seen, because God is the perfect object for which the stars move, God, in a sense, causes the eternal motion of the stars. And because the stars move eternally, we have a fixed eternal order in nature. So the whole of nature, that is the universe, has always existed and always will exist, much as we find it now. The universe, for Aristotle, is perfectly intelligible. He believes that his logic, with the theory of the syllogism at its center, provides the perfect structure for organizing knowledge within the various sciences. Ultimately, Aristotle thinks we can know what exists, why it exists, and how it differs from other things. Aristotle seeks to show how all existence must be understood through a small number of basic concepts. For example, every observable substance has an essence, a form, distinguishable from its matter, and every movement is a change from potentiality to actuality. In his work, The Physics, Aristotle attempts to prove that natural changes take place for some purpose. Hence, the members of all species strive to attain certain natural goals, that is, to fulfill their essences. The stars move in perfect motion around the earth to reach their goal of imitating God. And a man uses his own intellect to imitate God's nature as well. As we shall see, therein lies a tale about how man may share in a limited way in divine perfection.